For today's episode of So Many Books Little Time, we come with a content warning of violence against infants and torture, description of torture and racism and classism. Thank you.
Hey folks, Dave here.
Andrew.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
I forgot to let you say the second part of that last episode.
Whoops. Oh well.
Today we will be continuing Brave New World by Aldous Huxley with Chapter 2. Music!
And you.
So Rue, I hear you are in a bit of pain today.
Well, when am I not, Dave? When am I not? I just decided, it's not rough enough what you're going through normally. Let's just add an extra level and get burnt. So I had a little mishap with some very, very, very hot, sugary, syrupy stuff. And I'm actually lucky that it's only a burn of about, let me say, 2 centimeters.
It's on the back of her hand. It looks nasty. Yeah.
It looks nasty. It's in an awkward spot. It is at least a second degree burn. I'll see the doctor on Monday. I'm sorry to all healthcare people, anyone in the healthcare system, and anyone in the who are going to deal with disinfecting and cleaning and after the fact. Anyone who's in any which way involved in the outside world right now. I like to call it the outside world rather than my house. Anyone involved in the outside world right now to try and prevent the spread. I apologize that my preventable mishap is now going to add to your workload. As minuscule as it might be in the grand scheme of things, I still feel really bad. The guilt.
Well, I mean, I made the joke earlier that it must be pretty painful for you to even notice it and comment on it.
Yeah, I don't tend to notice things until they're pretty painful. I had a dislocated shoulder for 9 days once. Yeah, it wasn't fully dislocated. So, you know, I was like, it's fine. Oh, I can't move my arm properly. Oh, I'll be fine. It's probably just twinged. Went to the physio. Physio's like, dude, your scapula's out. I'm like, oh, okay. That explains why I couldn't use my arm.
When Rue told me this, we were playing World of Warcraft, and she was like, I was clumsy, because I went, oh, Rue. And I go, no, there's clumsy, and then there's you.
And I concede the point that it takes a special skill to forget or to switch off briefly and not be focused. I mean, look, anyone who's in hospitality is probably just going, yeah, okay, sugar burns happen, yeah. No, you don't understand. I'm usually super paranoid in the kitchen because I am clumsy in general life. And just that fraction of a second where you don't pay attention and, you know, there's a global pandemic going on, so you don't want to burden on the healthcare system. just bad. Just bad timing.
Yeah.
And painful. And I don't like pain on top of my pain. Pain on top of pain sucks. Shout out to the chronically ill and the disabled and the chronic pain folks out there. You know what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I can complain about at the moment is it's a bit hot.
Well, it is hot. It is sucky and hot. We had nice weather, and then it heated up again.
Yeah, for us, nice weather is when it is cool. But we've talked about this ad nauseum.
Yes.
Mind you, if we never talked about things we talked about before, we wouldn't have a podcast.
It wouldn't be consistent.
I think it's just that thing, you know, as you get older, you know, certain brain pathways get well worn, certain stories, certain topics of conversation, you get into routines. And.
But weather and temperature seem to be very universally human things. I'm sure there's a thesis out there that looks at it.
Well, we've talked about this before, and the theory we came up with then was it's a non-controversial method of conversation.
Sort of. As long as you don't go into the science and of weather and climate and distinctions between them and their the
Which we
consistency
brought
of
up as
patterns.
well.
Yeah, we did. We like this topic. It's an interesting one. We'll just make a new podcast called The Weathercast, which someone already has probably. And we are not meteorologists, so I'm just gonna let that go.
Is Dave and Rue with the Weathercast. It is a top of 28 today with cloudy
Degrees
skies.
Celsius. Degrees Celsius. Anyway.
Fahrenheit doesn't matter.
Sorry. There's like two places or three places in the world that use Fahrenheit. Deal. The rest
So
of the world does not.
now, at the la end of the last podcast, you were in a little bit of a rush, but we did have a good discussion regardless. Did you have and have you reflected a little on what happened last
Yeah,
chapter?
so I've reflected, and I think one of the things that's going to be irritating, I guess, but I have. Okay, so with science fiction, particularly older science fiction, where the understanding behind some of the science that we now know is like you have to mentally kind of go, okay, what did they know at the time? What did they not know at the time? Excuse me. Because it does make it tricky to read. I mean, even science fiction as recently as the late 90s. Or early 90s and late 80s, early 90s, late 90s, even now. I mean, Dave, were you there when we watched that the apocalyptic was it tomorrow, not Tomorrow When the World Began, the Day After Tomorrow?
No, I don't think I was there for that.
Anyone who is there in the cinema with me could hear me in the corner just slowly dying because it was that bad. I'm sorry, let's have an ice age that happens in 2 weeks as opposed to thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
Well,
No.
this reminds me of when I was doing some film subjects at uni. There was a guy in the class who was a gun enthusiast. I think he'd spent some time in the military, and he could not watch most Hollywood action movies because of how bad the use of guns were. It was all incorrect, the way they fired, the way they reloaded. It would just took him out of the movie because that was his passion, and he knew a lot about it.
I
Therefore, he
have
could not
that.
suspend his disbelief for the story because of the technical inaccuracies.
It takes a lot for me to be able to like everything else must work for me to suspend my disbelief. Does that make sense?
Now,
Like
but what we did talk about in regards to this, the fact that they're kind of getting the science out in the beginning, and maybe it helps to think this is how this universe
Yeah,
works.
so it's giving us. So I do. So it's kind of this weird thing. Like I said last time, I appreciate it when they make the settings, prepare the setting, so you know. Okay, in this world or in this sandbox universe, as we know from video games. So in this sandbox, this is how the rules of physics are. This is how the rules of genetics and inheritance and biology are. Even if it's a completely it clashes with inf no now known information, but we only know what we know when we know it.
So
So
in this universe, you can immunize a fetus before they develop an immune system.
by exposing them to the disease prior, yes, prior to them having an immune system.
That's the example I remembered from our discussion.
There's a couple. So if you heat the fetus, it will prefer heat. If you cool the fetus, it'll prefer cold. Okay, no.
What about
No.
the rocket technicians who they spin them upside down so they prefer being upside
We're going to expose. Yeah, because babies in utero are never upside down. That never happens. Anyway, but. Yeah, so there's many, many things that also very strongly indicate that Huxley was, I mean, we said this, he was around people with scientific background. He himself wanted to be a doctor, and that dream failed him because he became temporarily severely vision impaired. Not to say that you can't be a doctor when vision impaired, because there are some out there who are. But
But
in
maybe
terms for
not in the
him, at the
early,
time, no, at the time it was not a possibility for him. The thing that's really getting me though is that there is a certain niche of humanity. Okay, not humanity. There's a niche in career spaces that have always want, like when you want to be something else, specifically often if you want to be a doctor, but you couldn't go down that path, there's a fraction of those individuals who tend to either overcompensate, and I'm sure there's a name for it, I'm going with overcompensate, and they almost res they there's that almost underlying resentment and frustration, which is distinct, by the way, to physicians who become physicians and then are frustrated that their reality and what they envisaged is different. This is a different category. So it's fascinating, but there is does seem to be, particularly when it comes to healthcare and looking after other people and the station that it seems that physicians, and I don't want to use the word enjoy because enjoy is the wrong word. There's a station associated with being a physician in society, most global societies, that places it in that makes people envious of it.
Right,
Right?
because they often get well compensated for their work. They have the status
Well,
of being a healthcare professional.
yeah, and then there's a nobility ascribed to it as a profession, which, look, yes, it can be any form of healthcare can be an extremely noble calling when it is a calling and not a business. However, yeah, I have feelings on this. I haven't dissected it, but I can see how it's bleeding through in how Aldous is writing. Huxley's way of describing these things, he's ha I can already feel how he's half criticizing it and half longing to be within his where he was in his society, in his context, to be able to be the person who actually enjoys a certain status due to being able to make a difference in people's lives, maybe. Whereas what we okay, just a side note, this is an opinion, feeling, whatever you want to call it. I think that this is not to detract from the fact that we should respect physicians and clinicians and healthcare workers generally. I mean, especially right now, we're noticing what a load that they carry. And by the way, healthcare professionals, that includes our nurses, our scrubbing stuff, whatever is involved in healthcare, that involves standards that need to be met. I don't know, there's something about it that's just, you know what I mean? Like, I can't describe it properly. Like, we should, everyone has value in society. It's just that we don't necessarily appreciate it. Everyone has the ability to contribute. We just don't appreciate it. The same way that in Runaway in chapter one, you have this distinction made between menial and intellectual work.
And that they're, it's not that these, we've seen that these eggs are fit in these categories. It seems they're artificially manufacturing these categories based on
Yes.
numbers.
So there's this distinct classism and assumptions being made about the intellectual capacities required or like for certain roles. You're going, no, because how do you advance in a field if you don't have a diverse range of processing abilities? And also, why assume that just because someone, for example, is doing, I don't know, something that one would in society label as menial. Okay, is a farmhand. What the heck makes a farmhand less capable of contributing to society, both on an intellectual and physical level? And if you want, in terms of character, in terms of integrity, in terms of, this society already that is being described is incredibly. It echoes the attitudes that are very, I mean, they're pretty obvious to those who are marginalized, but they are maybe less obvious to those who haven't been in a position where they have been discriminated or marginalized, discriminated against or marginalized. So if you've never worked in retail, or you've never, if you're not a member of a minority, or if you've never worked as a cleaner or anything like that, you may not grasp just how bad and unhealthy this attitude is.
It permeates society.
It creates division. It slows us down as a civilization. I mean, 1984, the whole point was to slow down civilization to stagnancy.
Mm.
So this is just another way to do it, because you're trying to keep it within bounds that have been ascribed as being efficient and functional. I guess what it is with both 1984, and I mean, we've just done the first chapter of Brave New World, but I'm already getting the impression this is a completely artificial society.
Yeah.
As determined by a select few, which is similar to what we had in 1984. Now, I see why those two books, that you look at the same, it's the same story, but two different manufactured societies.
Yeah. It will be interesting, maybe at the end, to have a discussion about them both being horrible, but which might be preferable to live in, if you had to
neither.
Pick one.
Neither. So far, neither, because a manufactured society places limits on the capacity of what can be accomplished as a civilization. It's not civilization building, it's civilization stifling. And that's not, I wouldn't be comfortable. I mean, we already have variations of it.
Yeah.
To some level.
Yeah, the creep towards fascism in many countries these days is worrying.
Well, yeah. But then we'll see. I mean, this global crisis that we are currently going through, we have, I think I brought it up last time, what we used to perceive as normal, and what we keep saying we'll go back to normal. Do we really want to?
Yeah, normal wasn't cutting it for a lot of people.
I mean, normal is what got us into this mess to begin with. Normal is why we were so underprepared, because we defunded and devalued certain roles and needs in society for the financial benefit of a few. And no society in the world has been adequately prepared for this kind of situation. Some are quicker to respond.
Yeah, some have responded much better than others.
Well, they've responded in a way that has caused less potential long-term implications for their population.
And from what I understand, there seems to be a cultural component, because the societies where there is kind of a familial connection, or we're all in this together, they've been quicker to be able to self-quarantine, to be able to look after each other, whereas in the more individualistic societies, including the one we currently live in Australia, there's been less of that.
Yeah,
because people don't even, like, you want me to stay indoors? What is this?
Yeah, I think we need to, like, so far, I'm looking forward to, and it's going to sound very strange, I'm looking forward to the sociology papers that are going to come out of this crisis. That doesn't mean I want this crisis to exist or persist or people to be harmed by it, but hey, it's here now. And hopefully what we can learn out of it will be valuable in terms of transforming the way we approach things. I know that many are going to be cynical and kind of go, nothing will change, we didn't listen the first time, why would we listen now?
I've got a bit of that in me. Yeah,
I can understand that too. It's a reasonable, I guess the word is, it's not fear, it's a reasonable doubt.
Or I think it's a cynicism.
Well, but cynicism is, by its nature, it's a form of doubt. It's a doubt in the capacity that it will be addressed due to the actions or beliefs or functions of others.
Hmm.
So cynicism, yeah. But in this case, I'm actually thinking, we know now what the consequences of not listening to the epidemiologists and the researchers and the behavioralists and all this. They brought this all up way back when, in 2007 mm-hmm. and earlier, when we had the first SARS outbreak. I mean, we've had this come up earlier than that. This is not my specialty. But the SARS outbreak, back in 2007, they were saying there is a huge, huge danger here, that this is going to, we're going to have another zoonotic experience, and this time we will have zero ability to contain it.
Mm.
And it's raised again and again. But as I said, I'm curious to see And by that, I mean, I would be fascinated to see whether those societies were individualistic. Like, it doesn't, individualistic societies or collectivist societies, collectivist doesn't mean, shouldn't have to mean that the individual is not valued and cannot contribute and isn't important and their feelings aren't addressed and their opinions aren't important. It does, however, mean that we as individuals see ourselves as part of a society that we can shape and contribute towards, as opposed to how society serves us and only how we get what we want out of society.
Kind of I think of a balance, like you should probably be thinking of others as much as you think about yourself. There should be a balance between those two.
Yeah. And this is not a, just to make it blunt, this is not a communism versus capitalism thing. There are challenges and issues with both, at least in my very limited and inexpert opinion, mainly because they don't address every single facet of society, and that you can't have a society that only functions for for others when you don't also take into account individual adapted needs. For example, our disabled community, our vulnerable population. In a society that is purely collectivist, you have you run the risk of a eugenic tendency, or just, okay, well, the elderly can sacrifice themselves for the well-being.
Yep.
For example. And that happens in the other extreme as well, when you have an individualistic society, they think, well, they can sacrifice themselves for me and mine.
Yeah, for neither my stock portfolio.
For the economic well-being. So neither are helpful and neither are healthy strategies. I think getting to know each other and being... One beautiful thing that has been coming out, and I know you avoid the news, there has been a glimmering of hope in terms of community. Community is definitely trying its best. Yes, there are lots of individuals that are not necessarily benefiting from that yet. But it's definitely, there is hope. I think hope is the important thing to maintain. Hope is important. Hope is the great counteractor to cynicism.
And because we've been talking about hope and optimism, what better way to continue that strain by jumping into a dystopia?
Of course.
So, are you ready, Rue?
Ready to roll.
2. Mr. Foster was left in the decanting room. The DHC and his students stepped into the nearest lift and were carried up to the 5th floor. Infant nurseries, Neo-Pavlovian conditioning rooms, announced the notice board. The director opened a door. They were in a large bare room, very bright and sunny, for the whole of the southern wall was a single window. Half a dozen nurses, trousered and jacketed in the regulation white viscose linen uniform, their hair aseptically hidden under white caps, were engaged in setting out bowls of roses in a long row across the floor. Big bowls, packed tight with blossom, thousands of petals, ripe-blown and silkily smooth, like the cheeks of innumerable little cherubs, but of cherubs, in that bright light, not exclusively pink and Aryan, but also luminously Chinese, also Mexican, also apoplectic with too much blowing of celestial trumpets, also pale as death, pale with the posthumous whiteness of marble. Nurses stiffened to attention as the DHC came in. "Set out the books," he said curtly. In silence, the nurses obeyed his command. Between the rose bowls, the books were duly set out. A row of nursery quartos opened invitingly, each at some gaily colored image of beast or fish or bird. "Now bring in the children." They hurried out of the room and returned in a minute or two, each pushing a kind of tall dumbwaiter laden on all its 4 wire netted shelves with 8-month-old babies, all exactly alike, a Bokanovsky group, it was evident, and all, since their caste was Delta, dressed in khaki. "Put them down on the floor." The infants were unloaded. "Now, turn them so they can see the flowers and books." Turned, the babies at once fell silent, then began to crawl towards those clusters of sleek colors, those shapes so gay and brilliant on the white pages. As they approached, the sun came out of a momentary eclipse behind a cloud. The roses flamed up as though with a sudden passion from within. A new and profound significance seemed to suffuse the shining pages of the books. From the ranks of the crawling babies came little squeals of excitement, gurgles and twitterings of pleasure. The director rubbed his hands. "Excellent," he said. "It might almost have been done on purpose." The swiftest crawlers were already at their goal. Small hands reached out uncertainly, touched, grasped, unpetaling the transfigured roses, crumpling the illuminated pages of the books. The director waited until all were happily busy. Then, "Watch carefully," he said. And lifting his hand, he gave the signal. The head nurse, who was standing by a switchboard at the other end of the room, pressed down a little lever. There was a violent explosion. Shriller and ever shriller, a siren shrieked. Alarm bells maddeningly sounded. The children started, screamed. Their faces were distorted with terror. "And now," the director shouted, for the noise was deafening, "now we proceed to rub in the lesson with a mild electric shock." He waved his hand again, and the head nurse pressed a second lever. The screaming of the babies suddenly changed its tone. There was something desperate, almost insane, about the sharp, spasmodic yelps to which they now gave utterance. Their little bodies twitched and stiffened. Their limbs moved jerkily as if to the tug of unseen wires. "We can electrify that whole strip of floor," bawled the director in explanation. "But that's enough," he signaled to the nurse. Yes. Mm-mm. Rue has the biggest frown on her face at the moment. I'll just continue, shall I? Mm-hmm. The explosion ceased. The bell stopped ringing. The shriek of the siren died down from tone to tone into silence. The stiffly twitching bodies relaxed, and what had become the sob and yelp of infant maniacs broadened out once more into a normal howl of ordinary terror. "Offer them the flowers and the books again." The nurses obeyed, but at the approach of the roses, at the mere sight of those gaily colored images of Pussy and Cock-a-Doodle-Doo and Baa-baa Black Sheep, the infants shrank away in horror. The volume of their howling suddenly increased. "Observe," said the director triumphantly, "observe. Books and loud noises, flowers and electric shocks, already in the infant mind, these couples were compromisingly linked. And after 200 repetitions of the same or a similar lesson would be wedded indissolubly. What man has joined, nature is powerless to put asunder. They'll grow up with what the psychologists used to call an instinctive hatred of books and flowers, reflexes unalterably conditioned. They'll be safe from books and botany all their lives." The director turned to his nurses. "Take them away again." Still yelling, the cocky babies were loaded onto their dumbwaiters and wheeled out, leaving behind them the smell of sour milk and a most welcome silence. One of the students held up his hand, and though he could quite see well why you couldn't have lower caste people wasting the community's time over books, and that there was always the risk of their reading something which might undesirably decondition one of their reflexes, yet, well, he couldn't understand about the flowers. Why go to the trouble of making it psychologically impossible for deltas to like flowers? Patiently, the DHC explained, if the children were made to scream at the sight of a rose, that was on grounds of high economic policy. Not so very long ago, a century or thereabouts, gammas, deltas, even epsilons had been conditioned to like flowers, flowers in particular, and wild nature in general. The idea was to make them want to be going out into the country at every available opportunity, and so compel them to consume transport. And didn't they consume transport? Asked the student. Quite a lot, the DHC replied, but nothing else. Primroses and landscapes, he pointed out, have one grave defect. They are gratuitous. A love of nature keeps no factories busy. It was decided to abolish the love of nature, at any rate among the lower classes, to abolish the love of nature, but not the tendency to consume transport. For of course it was essential that they keep on going to the country, even though they hated it. The problem was to find an economically sounder reason for consuming transport than a mere affection for primroses and landscapes. We condition the masses to hate the country, concluded the director, but simultaneously we condition them to love all country sports. At the same time, we see to it that all country sports shall entail the use of elaborate apparatus, so that they consume manufactured articles as well as transport. Hence these electric shocks. I see, said the student, and was silent, lost in admiration. There was a silence then, clearing his throat. Once upon a time, the director began, while our Ford was still on Earth, there was a little boy called Ruben Rabinovich. Ruben was the child of Polish-speaking parents. The director interrupted himself. You know what Polish is, I suppose. A dead language. Like French and German, added another student, officiously showing off his learning. And parent? Questioned the DHC. There was an uneasy silence. Several of the boys blushed. They had not yet learned to draw the significant but often very fine distinction between smut and pure science. One at last had the courage to raise a hand. Human beings used to be... He hesitated. The blood rushed to his cheeks. Well, they used to be viviparous. Quite right, the director nodded approvingly. And when the babies were decanted, born came the correction. Well, then they were the parents. I mean, not the babies, of course, the other ones. The poor boy was overwhelmed with confusion. In brief, the director summed up, the parents were the father and the mother. The smut that was really science fell with a crash into the boy's eye, avoiding silence. Mother, he repeated loudly, rubbing in the science. And leaning back in his chair, these, he said gravely, are unpleasant facts. I know it. But then most historical facts are unpleasant. He returned to little Reuben. To little Reuben, in whose room, one evening, by an oversight, his father and mother, crash, crash, happened to leave the radio turned on. For you must remember that in those days of gross viviparous reproduction, children were always brought up by their parents and not in state conditioning centers. While the child... Sorry, your frown is very amusing every time I look up.
Yeah, I'm like, ew, gross.
While the child was asleep, a broadcast program from London suddenly started to come through. And the next morning, to the astonishment of his crash and crash, the more daring of the boys ventured to grin at one another, little Reuben woke up repeating word for word a long lecture by that curious old writer, one of the very few whose works have been permitted to come down to us, George Bernard Shaw, who was speaking, according to a well-authenticated tradition, about his own genius. To little Reuben's wink and snigger, this lecture was, of course, perfectly incomprehensible, and imagining that their child had suddenly gone mad, they sent for a doctor. He fortunately understood English, recognized the discourse as that which Shaw had broadcasted the previous evening, realized the significance of what had happened, and sent a letter to the medical press about it.
Okay, 1 second. Let me just think. So he was asleep, he hears this broadcast, and he's repeating it verbatim. Yes. Okay, good. Thank you.
The principle of sleep teaching, or hypnopedia, had been discovered. The DHT made an impressive pause. The principle had been discovered, but many, many years were to elapse before that principle was usefully applied. The case of little Reuben occurred only 23 years after our Ford's first T model was put on the market. Here the director made a sign of the T on his stomach, and all the students reverentially followed suit.
I'm sorry, what? Okay, yep, okay, yes,
Do you have an inkling of who Ford is?
Yeah, Ford, inventor of the T-Bird, but I'm just kind of having a moment of, okay then.
And remember,
so it's a religion, yes, great.
Remember before you said, I think it was, they used the AF after the year, and you're like, what is after Ford?
Yes, that makes sense, yes.
And yet, furiously, the student scribbled, Hypnopedia, first used officially in AF 214, here we go. Why not before? Two reasons. A. These early experimenters, the DHT was saying, were on the wrong track. They thought that Hypnopedia could be made an instrument of intellectual education. A small boy asleep on his right side, the right arm stuck out, the right hand hanging limp over the edge of the bed. Through a round grating in the side of a box, a voice speaks slowly. The Nile is the longest river in Africa, and the second in length of all the rivers of the globe. Although falling short of the length of the Mississippi, Missouri, the Nile is at the head of all rivers as regards the length of its basin, which extends through 35 degrees of latitude. At breakfast the next morning, "Tommy," someone says, "do you know which is the longest river in Africa?" A shaking of the head. "But don't you remember something that begins, 'The Nile is the longest river in Africa, and the second in length of all the rivers of the globe.'" The words come rushing out, although falling short of, "Well now, which is the longest river in Africa?" The eyes are blank. "I don't know." "But the Nile, Tommy. The Nile is the longest river in Africa, and second..." "Then which river is the longest, Tommy?" Tommy burst into tears. "I don't know," he howls. That howl, the director made it plain, discouraged the earliest investigators. The experiments were abandoned. No further attempt was made to teach children the length of the Nile in their sleep. Quite rightly, you can't learn a science unless you know what it's all about. Whereas, if they'd only started on moral education," said the director, leading the way towards the door. The students followed him, desperately scribbling as they walked and all the way up in the lift. Moral education, which ought never, in any circumstances, to be rational. "Silence, silence," whispered a loudspeaker as they stepped out at the 14th floor, and "Silence, silence," the Trumpet Mouse indefatigably repeated at intervals down every corridor. The students and even the director himself rose automatically to the tips of their toes. They were alphas, of course, but even alphas have been well conditioned. "Silence, silence." All the air of the 14th floor was sibilant with the categorical imperative. 50 yards of tiptoeing brought them to a door which the director cautiously opened. They stepped over the threshold into the twilight of a shuttered dormitory. 80 cots stood in a row against the wall. There was a sound of light, regular breathing and a continuous murmur, as of very faint voices remotely whispering. A nurse rose as they entered and came to attention before the director. "What's the lesson this afternoon?" he asked. "We had elementary sex for the first 40 minutes," she answered, "but now it's switched over to elementary class consciousness." The director walked slowly down the long line of cots. Rosy and relaxed with sleep, 80 little boys and girls lay softly breathing. There was a whisper under every pillow. The DHC halted and, bending over one of the little beds, listened attentively. "Elementary class consciousness, did you say? Let's have it repeated a little louder by the trumpet." At the end of the room, a loudspeaker projected from the wall. The director walked up to it and pressed a switch. "All wear green," said a soft but very distinct voice, beginning in the middle of a sentence, "and Delta children wear khaki. Oh no, I don't want to play with Delta children, and Epsilons are still worse. They're too stupid to be able to read or write. Besides, they wear black, which is such a beastly color. I'm so glad I'm a beta." There was a pause, and then the voice began again. "Alpha children wear gray. They work much harder than we do, because they're so frightfully clever. I'm really awfully glad I'm a beta, because I don't work so hard. And then we are much better than the Gammas and Deltas. Gammas are stupid. They all wear green, and Delta children wear khaki. Oh no, I don't want to play with Delta children, and Epsilons are still worse. They're too stupid to be able..." The director pushed back the switch. The voice was silent. Only its thin ghost continued to mutter from beneath the 80 pillows. "And they'll have that repeated 40 or 50 times more before they wake, then again on Thursday, and again on Saturday. 123 times a week for 30 months, after which they go on to a more advanced lesson, roses and electric shocks, the khaki of deltas, and a whiff of asafoetida wedded indissolubly before the children can speak. But wordless conditioning is crude and wholesale, cannot bring home the finer distinctions, cannot inculcate the more complex courses of behavior. For that there must be words, but words without reason. In brief, hypnopedia. The greatest moralizing and socializing force of all time. The students took it down in their little books, straight from the horse's mouth. Once more, the director touched the switch. "So frightfully clever," the soft, insinuating, indefatigable was saying. "I'm really awfully glad I'm a beta, because..." "Not so much like drops of water, though water, it is true, can wear holes in the hardest granite. Rather, drops of liquid sealing wax, drops that adhere, encrust, incorporate themselves with what they fall on, till finally the rock is all one scarlet blob."
It makes sense because it doesn't make sense in the sense of, no, this is not a thing. Not really.
Yeah, we can't learn through listening in our sleep.
Listening to taste in our sleep, no. No. But it is in the sense of the way they're describing it, that, you know how we say this idea of water reforming, making holes in the hardest granite. That's the idea of actually shaping a mind and causing change that's permanent, right? This one, it's almost like you're putting that layer upon layer upon layer on top of it so that the mind doesn't actually get a chance to form like that aspect of their opinion or their feelings or their thoughts aren't forming. Like they're just trapping it in this one static space. It's I can't describe it very yet.
Yeah, what they're teaching them is getting slathered on top.
Yeah. And this idea of they're forming the mind as opposed to transforming a mind.
Mm. Till at last the child's mind is these suggestions, and the sum of the suggestions is the child's mind, and not the child's mind only, the adult's mind too, all his life long, the mind that judges and desires and decides, made up of these suggestions, but all these suggestions are our suggestions. The director almost shouted in his triumph, suggestions from the state. He banged the nearest table. It therefore follows. A noise made him turn around. Oh, Ford, he said in another tone, I've gone and woken the children. And that is chapter two.
Yeah. It's interesting. No. No. We don't like it at all. No. And anyone who does is a monster. I think we actually have degrees of this in society where we're surrounded by attitudes and certain phrases. That's, you know how they say kids pick up prejudice from their environment? Yeah. That's it. Like, how is this any different?
Well, this is maybe more overtly calculated.
This is, state sanctioned and state created. And I mean, we do have that in terms of propaganda. We have that in terms of cultural biases that are continued on through generations. It takes critical thinking. It takes encouraging critical thinking and developing a mind that also appreciates and values to break free from that. That's going to be, that's hard. Are we going to have another Winston? Because at this rate, I don't see this working very well. Unless someone really stuffed up in the programming stage,
I do like the little things about how when the Polish doctor first discovered this and they tried to put it into practice, the kids could repeat exactly what they heard, but there was a dissonance between what they heard and understanding what they heard. And so the almost the evilness of it, the director says, well, they were trying to use it to teach things. But we're using it to imbue morals.
Yeah, which is disturbing in itself, because morals are the idea is that morals in this world, not this world, in this book's world, are subconscious. Like they're not a deliberate and a choice that one works on. Whereas I actually would say that's not something I necessarily agree with. I think they're influenced by things that are subconscious. Like if you are constantly surrounded by super racist talk, or you are living in a society that has racially charged structures, you don't realize that you've been programmed. We have that. We do have programming. When you don't realize, it doesn't occur to someone, okay, so I'm going to describe something that's not just that I just read yesterday that made me go, how could someone not know? So on a Reddit forum on one of the ones, AITI, yes, AITA, sorry, am I the, someone described, I don't understand, I did this thing, I really stuffed up with my friend because his parents are illegal immigrants. And I thought it would be funny for April Fool's Day to have people dress up, get some teaching assistants to dress up as in suits and pretend to be ICE agents. And now my friends blocked me on all social media and won't talk to me, and I've tried to apologize and I didn't think that it would be a problem. Yeah, the reason people don't think it's going to be a problem, like how that particular person could get into an unthinking mindset, is because they didn't think just what that might mean. They weren't aware of what it means. You think it's just a prank, for example, but it's not just a prank.
Yeah.
because it has a significant implication. Like, it's a racially charged, unsettled, uncertain, endangered system. But you don't. And I couldn't understand how that wasn't an obvious thing. But then I thought, wait, if you are in an environment where you don't realize that you are in an environment that is racist.
Oh, yeah,
you don't realize that.
The people who think they're immune to propaganda are the most susceptible because they don't realize just what you're saying, that the culture we live in shapes certain views.
Yeah, and they themselves might genuinely not, like, it's like the people who say, oh, but I'm not racist. Like, no, you can't say that you're not racist. What you can say is you strive to break down the racism. Like, you don't go out, you work on the prejudice that you may have. Everyone has bias.
Yep.
Everyone has inbuilt bias. And I mean, bias is not the same as racism, but we navigate systems that are affected by racism. So even if you directly aren't, you don't think you're directly benefiting from racism against someone else, you may be, and you probably are.
Probably are, yeah.
Yeah, probably are. Unless you are the colonized person, yeah, usually there's that exception. But even then,
it's
messy.
Yeah, because, you know, people are ignorant. Even the most marginalized groups are ignorant of other groups.
They can be. I mean, it's not about a, let's not start the whole, not that you would, but this is not about, let's have the suffering Olympics, let's compare. I think that's
no,
where...
Well, no one can know everything. We're all ignorant about some group of people,
yes,
experiences of other, of how other people live.
Yeah, and I think we have to also be careful that racism is not necessarily ignorance. Racism is usually quite deliberate. It's just that we don't realize that we're part of something that is deliberate at
times. It's, I'd say, weaponized prejudice.
Yes, is part of it, yeah. I think we don't... So there's this move, for example, to... So going back to the book, we have this... They're being very blatant about it, very open about it. And in some spaces, people are blatant and open about it.
Mm.
But I think what's more insidious and what's much more dangerous is this environmentally absorbed and not even realizing, and until you've actually been confronted by it and get over that discomfort that, oh, I actually do, I do have benefits in this society that I don't realize I have simply by the fact that I am not as heavily discriminated against as someone else,
mm-hmm.
or I am advantaged because of simply who I was born to and how I was born.
And let me say, as a white man, confronting that idea can be very painful.
It can be very painful. And I think it's about, and this is not about being callous towards that. The pain is, if we learn to embrace that pain, this is not about not to be masochistic, but if we learn to embrace that particular pain as one that helps us grow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no.
We would advance as a society much more.
When I say pain, especially in because I was originally in America before coming to Australia, and in both societies, as a white male, the prejudice that affects other groups in these societies doesn't affect me at all. I had to be aware that such prejudice existed, so that when you hear, you know, people are racist, you tend to think it's a very overt thing. It was, for a long time, I was blind to the idea that this, like, the systems were just built up in a way to be affecting some groups more than others. Because the accusation of being racist or sexist, especially when you don't feel that that's ever been part of your life, can feel accusatory, and it takes some self-examination and definitely listening to those who are affected by this in order to overcome. That's what I mean when I say pain, the idea that you're being unjustly accused of something when
Then
it is an ignorance that you didn't even realize this was going on. It's not to excuse my past behavior or anyone else who benefits from these systems, but yeah, listening is important.
yes, listening is important in learning, and I think learning doesn't happen without being confronted by some things which are difficult. And I think the test is being confronted and actually trying to see how can I actively address this, not just in myself, but in the society I live in. Like to realize that even if we feel as though we're powerless, we're not. And I'm not talking about minorities here. I'm talking about, like, I am technically in some ways a minority, but I know that compared to someone else, I might have more power to enact or change something, and that I should do that so that others may not be, like, even if it's not going to have an immediate effect, that I'm working towards something that will, in the long term, break down these past systems and contribute to something new. Like, I'm not focusing personally, I don't focus as much on breaking down the previous system because the previous system is not really sustainable. So what I focus on is A, identifying, this isn't healthy, this isn't working, this is discrimination, this is prejudice, this is steeped in a sense of superiority by one group over another. This is not actually founded in information that is factual. It is information that is projected based on a philosophy, and the philosophy of superiority. And so it's no longer applicable, and therefore I need to work on what can I do that breaks that up? What can I do that's different to that? What can I offer that's different to that? What is needed? And not just projecting what I think is needed, but also identifying what is it that the populations affected specifically has stated will be helpful. And if I want to offer something, I go run it by them, find out, or read. Maybe not make them have to do all the work,
Yeah, there's that as
but
well.
like I'm responsible for looking things up. I'm responsible for reading and figuring it out. And if I struggle with the comprehension because I can't, even recognizing that, for example, someone just pointed out if you are someone who works with people with disabilities or who works as a disabled care, a carer towards people who are disabled, you are not a member of the disabled community. Unless you are actually disabled yourself, you are not part of that community. If you're a parent to a disabled child, you are still not technically a member of the disabled community. You are adjacent, you are very close, you are involved with, but you are not technically a member. It's the same way you could be an adopted member. I don't know. It's you're not, like, simply in fact, unless you are, you're not. And it's not using that as a point of division, but rather going, this is important, because that means when someone who is disabled is talking or expressing something from what they're experiencing, it doesn't matter if you've had 30, 40, 50 years experience working with someone who is disabled. You are silencing that voice by speaking over it.
And I think also we're talking about groups in this discussion, but what you just pointed out, really, we're all people. So what you've said about that is that, yeah, a mother might be looking after, like, maybe I don't want to actually name disorders, but their child has this one thing, and then they're listening to someone else who suffers with another of affliction. And they might have all this experience with their child, but what this person has is completely different. They have different needs and they have a different experience. So yeah, while some of it may be applicable, yeah, it's better to just listen to what they're going through.
It's if the main thing is, yes, we have differences, we should focus on what we have in common.
Yeah, there's
We
that
should
too.
focus on what we have in common and work on that as our foundation, but at the same time, recognize that there are different points of view that are founded on experience and how one interacts and navigates in this world, and put also place that importance. So not speak on a topic if we are not from that population, like, or at least we can speak on it, but we should defer to the experience and the output from that population, if that
Yeah,
makes
it's
sense.
yeah, I was thinking about that earlier this week, but it's very similar to what we talked about earlier, that balance between being an individual and then caring about others. Your own personal experience is very important because that's what makes you you. But then again, we have far more in common as people than we do differences. So to keep both things in mind.
So it's kind of we're constantly navigating when it comes to information, but also emotion, but also being respectful and I think there's nothing wrong with admitting that we can't know or don't know at a point. And I think that's where it comes down to as well. Anyway, back to cycling back to the
Oh,
book
yes, I did
because
want to
we've
ask you about a couple things that happened in the
go
chapter.
for it. Yeah.
One of them was about how, when he was questioning the students about the idea of families, mothers and fathers, the kids, felt it was smut, like those words were completely
Well,
taboo.
they've been conditioned because didn't he say they're alphas? So they're all alphas, right?
I'm unsure, but
No, he was saying in the thing it said, 1 second.
the fact that they're getting toured around a facility by a director probably does give,
Indicate that they're alpha.
yeah.
They're not betas. These are not betas. As far as I've understood it, just based on what the conditioning is sounding like in this thing, the betas are, I guess, they're there, they have their role, but they're also being like they're not working as hard as our alphas, right? So our epsilons, our gammas, and all the rest of them, menial and in different levels.
And they're all color-coded.
Yeah, and they're all color-coded, which is a whole nother thing. Gammas are stupid. They all wear green. Delta, oh no, I don't want to hang out with them. Alpha wear gray. They work so much frightfully. They're so smart. So they're told that they're all smart, but not only that, they're going to be conditioned as well. The alphas are going to be conditioned in the sense of you're busy, your duty is to do X, Y, and Z, right? Whereas the betas probably are there as far as I'm predicting. I don't know, I haven't actually read this. I'm going to assume the betas, they can engage in leisure and distraction. So alphas and beta, well, all the society parents don't exist anymore, but for the idea of viviparous, the fact that we're talking about live births and things like that, I can understand why they wouldn't know the concept, or they'd consider it smut, because I don't think alphas actually think in terms of sex. That's the understanding I've had.
Oh,
Or at least.
I don't think anyone does. Oh, well, okay, yes, sex is very important, but in a different way, and we'll get to that later.
Okay. Because
But
I'm getting an impression that's why, and this idea of familial relationships is smut, because that's you don't have a relationship anymore. The relationship is you for the state. And your function of your class for the state. That's what I'm getting from this, at least, which makes sense why I think they've been conditioned to consider family relationships and friendships and things like that to be smut or unworthy or not good. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah,
Okay.
on that topic of extracurricular activity, there was that small bit about how we created in like the deltas and gammas a love of sports, but very complicated sports with advanced apparatus, as they put. We get more into that later.
No, that makes sense.
Almost like it reminds me in 1984 how the proles played the lottery.
Yes, very much so. So it makes sense to do that. Like, yeah, it's distraction. It's distraction technique. And the more I reflect on those bits of 1984 and even now, the idea of recreational things that are useful, that keeps them busy, healthy, but busy. Yeah. No. Oh dear. Sorry,
And
my
let's see how.
bandage keeps falling off, so I'm like, try.
And at the start of the chapter, they were, I'm just trying to remember, it was
The conditioning, the physical.
Oh, yes, it was
The
the
baby
it,
torture.
yes, the baby torture.
Yeah, that, no. 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 No.
How the
No.
floor was shocked.
No. Yeah, no. I think I can't reflect on it much
Okay.
more because it's just something that makes me angry.
Yeah,
So,
it was a pretty horrific.
yeah. So I just got angry and
Rue did have, every time I looked up at the webcam footage, there was a very big frown on her face
yeah, no,
as I was reading.
I was not happy with that section because A, it's disturbing, and even just the thought of it occurring is not, no. Like, I'm sure it does occur to some level in some settings, which is why I just kind of go, nope. Nope. Like it's also not, it's not known to be an effective long term, like it destroys.
Well, everything so far we've come across isn't scientifically sound.
No, none of it is scientifically sound, but also it like the long term mental health consequences, the long term the way the brain actually functions, like if you are exposed to physical and emotional trauma when you are young, it stunts your ability to function.
Yeah.
You can overcome it, but it takes so much longer and it is so much harder.
Yeah.
Like you are immediately severely disadvantaged. I mean, that's the whole point of doing this to the deltas and the epsilons, right? Those were
Wasn't, oh
deltas.
yeah. It was then
Yeah.
when they went into the room with the recording, that was for betas.
Yes. So this was for the deltas where they're trying to keep them kind of very, very curtailed in their
Books are
interests.
bad, flowers are bad.
Yeah, they don't want them thinking, they just want them working. To be honest, so far I'm seeing it, I don't want anyone thinking. Even the alphas are not really thinking as much as they are repeating previous rhetoric.
Yeah, they're
Even the
following their
director.
programming.
Yeah, so none of the, so all of them are following their programming from alpha down to the very end of the trail. But yeah, so I was annoyed, angry, frustrated, all of the negative emotions. It's gonna probably take a while to process that one.
Oh, well, perhaps we'll have more effective conversations at the start of each episode when you've had a, some time to.
I think that's kind of what happened with 1984 as well, because some of the topics, some of the episodes that we had to do that because I just couldn't, like,
No, I understand it, yeah.
yeah, it's disturbing, very disturbing.
Anything else you'd like to bring up?
No, I think it's like we've established the science is not sound, but also technically we know that a lot of these things aren't going to do the very opposite, not the conditioning, but the Pavlovian thing. Like, it's not helpful. That's how you create a population that's completely useless. But yeah, it's a very. You remember how you had raised how it's 1984 was a reflection or a response to some socialist societies that Orwell had visited,
I
if
think he
not read
went,
about.
yeah, I think he went into Russia in the 30s
Yeah, so he had
or 20s,
actually.
maybe, because he probably couldn't have got in the 30s.
I don't know, it's all very. Yeah, but yeah, we looked it up and we kind of went, okay, this is his response or reflection in the context of the very worst case scenario, if the, how far you could possibly push in a dystopian way that particular society or that kind of ideology. And I think I see what you mentioned then, that Brave New World is a little bit more like the capitalist or consumerist society, but pushed with that societal programming idea, yeah, population programming. And I can see it because if we've got, like, you're telling them you are going to be repelled by this product and that product to improve our efficiency for this and that, but we still want you to consume, therefore we will keep you going with the sports and the this and the that. So it made sense. We want them to be consuming transport, but we want them not to waste transport in terms of what benefits us as a society.
Yeah, a love of
Wow.
nature is not economically viable.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, I was looking at it going, but reality is it would be, but again, in the context of he's taking industrialization and capitalism to the nth degree, like almost, it's almost ridiculing it.
They worship Henry Ford.
I know, well, yes. That makes me laugh because it makes me go, wow, he is really, really mocking. Like, this is the kind of mocking you would expect. Yeah, mocking Henry Ford is great. So on that note, I think... In the year, what year AF are we in? I don't know.
It was 212 something, I think.
Well, that is, but when was the Ford T-Bird? I'm looking this up.
And AF would stand for after Ford, so it's probably when he died. Mm. When Huxley wrote this book, I think Ford was still alive then.
So the T-Bird, we are currently AF 116.
Okay.
I think. Oh, well, Ford Company existed then. I don't know when they started. When was the first Ford?
Because I think the whole thing about worshipping Ford was his adoption of the assembly line to create his cars.
Yes.
That
yes.
Economic efficiency.
Yes. Which is disturbing on so many levels.
And you notice even when the director swore at the end and banged his table, he said, ah, Ford.
Yeah, so they worship him as a god. It's very disturbing. 1891, potentially. The Model T. I'm looking up Ford. I think that's what we should do, is like, look up Ford. What's going on with Ford? At age 15, Ford dismantled and reassembled the timepieces of friends and neighbors, so straight away he was a capitalist.
We're not going through the whole Ford biography. Not. We already went through Huxley's last episode.
Yes, no. Ford is messed up.
Shall we?
Well, Ford. But yes. Okay, so yes, in the year, I think, I want to know the year it started so we can sign off with the year of the Ford, but it's okay. It's fine.
We're going to help. Probably someone online has done that.
Yes, someone can find out what year, and we'll find out what year Ford it is next time. And we can open in the year four of our Ford. I'm sorry.
If the internet affords us that luxury.
In the year of our Ford, 181.
But so, yes. The music at the top of our podcast was Soma by Lionel Moser.
And the music at the end of the podcast is, as always, I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa.
You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Roo McMoo, RooMcMoo, or our podcast at SLT Podcast, which is both at Twitter and Facebook.
If you would like to email us, that is smbsltpodcast@gmail.com. If you are enjoying the show, please leave a review. Please leave some feedback wherever you feel appropriate. We'd love to hear what people are thinking, especially now that we've ventured onto yet another novel.
Yes. A novel.
They're all novel.
So bad. Okay. And on that note, hope you stay safe and stay home as much as possible. That is reasonable.
Catch up on your reading.
Yes. Read more books. Share them with friends. Share podcasts. Give reviews to podcasts. Do whatever you want to do. But still, mainly stay safe, please. Thank you.
Goodbye, folks.
Bye.